very much for coming on. So for anyone watching and listening, me and you have known each other for years and years and years. We're friends, but we also work together, so you're the chief technology officer at DataVita. Yeah. And ever since I've been doing these podcasts, I've been wanting to get you on because I think you've got an important story to be told.
Absolutely.
One of the things that always gets me about what you're about to talk about is most of us don't realise how much life can change in a 24-hour period and how much we all take our health for granted. Until that's taken away from you, we all just assume it's going to be that way. So let's go back 2 years almost to the day, isn't it?
Yeah, two years yesterday.
2 years yesterday.
2 years yesterday. Very vivid in my memory.
No wonder. So let's go back to that fateful weekend. You finished work on a Friday.
Yep.
You came in work Friday. Life's good. Everything's fine.
Working on a big customer project. Everything was good. Friday, everything was going well on the project. Great. Happy. Home. Looking forward to a nice weekend with the family. It was Mother's Day on the Sunday. So I had a regular Saturday. I was actually out on the Saturday for dinner with friends and my wife Christine. And all fine. Got up early on the Sunday morning, take my daughter to tennis. Had a normal day on the Sunday. No prior symptoms, no warnings, no nothing. Had dinner at my in-laws that night. Went home. Got to about 10:30 in the evening, decided to go to bed early because I got up early for work on Monday. Went to bed at 10:30, absolutely fine, as normal. Woke up at 1:30 a.m. in the morning with the worst pain I've ever felt in my life in my stomach, to the point where I was literally doubled over and passing out with how painful it was.
That's incredible. I always thought it, for some reason, I've never asked you that question about kind of leading up to it. I always thought you maybe felt crap during the day and a twinge, like you'd pulled something.
That's the thing for me, and that was the biggest thing for me, Danny. It was totally no prior warnings or anything. Felt right as rain the whole day and in the lead up to it. Nothing, I never even had problems with my stomach in the past.
Mm-hmm. So you had this twinge, you were doubled over in pain. I take it straight to hospital.
Well, my wife Christine is a nurse, as you know. Mm-hmm. So she phoned NHS 24 and their recommendation was go to A&E. So we live in Hamilton, so Hare Myers was the closest A&E for us. So Christine took me in the car, rushed me up to A&E. Mm-hmm. Got to A&E, and as you know, A&E can be busy. Uh-huh. Into the triage area. By the time we got to A&E, I was literally slumped over the counter, and I think the staff realised very quickly my bum didn't even hit the seat in the waiting area, and they took me straight through. Obviously, a relatively young man, no prior medical history, so it was straight into things like chest x-rays and all sorts of tests and getting lines into me so that they could give me pain relief and stuff like that. So, and it kind of really went for there.
And at first, what did they think it was?
They didn't know.
They
had no idea what it was whatsoever. So that was what led to all these chest x-rays, and I eventually got CT scans. I've had quite a lot of CT scans. My body must be irradiated, the many CT scans I've had. And what's the other one? The big tube.
MRI.
The MRI, sorry. No. Can you think
big
that
tube's
it?
Fine.
Big tube. That is actually very scary, that MRI. You are literally, your nose is touching the kind of top of the tunnel. And when you're in that tunnel, they put music on for you and stuff to try and relax you. But it was 15 minutes I had to be in it for. And they give you a kind of an alarm that you can press. And it got to must have been about 12 minutes in, and I was so close to pressing the button to get out of there. It was horribly claustrophobic.
Yeah.
It was horrible. But anyway, the whole thing, all these tests eventually and all these scans, etc., it led to them telling me I had acute pancreatitis. I knew that the human body had a pancreas, but I didn't actually know. Probably a lot of people didn't really know very much about what its function was, what it does. And it actually turns out it's quite key to your whole body.
And it can try and kill you.
Yeah, and it can definitely try and kill you.
So at that point, you didn't really understand the severity of what you were about to go into, because I can remember you texting me on the Monday morning saying, was in hospital at the weekend, sitting here waiting for more tests, but we were texting back and forward, and it all seemed relatively okay at that point. And I guess at that point you're thinking, I'm going to be in here for a couple of days, then bouncing straight back out.
Yeah, I guess like anything, I mean, you just, when you think you're fit and healthy and you've not got any prior medical history, you just think, well, it's maybe just a sore stomach. Mm-hmm. Obviously it's quite a sore stomach, but I just assumed it would be a case of they would get me back on my feet and I'd be out when a week or so.
And that led to, I guess you were in here, Myers, for a few weeks, weren't you?
I think it was somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks I was in here, Myers.
And during that time it was just getting worse and worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, my condition deteriorated quite a bit in there. They hadn't really, from a treatment point of view, for pancreatitis is a kind of watch and wait policy. There seems to be a watch and wait, because what happens is your body starts releasing sort of collections of fluid and stuff inside your body in places you shouldn't have collections of fluid.
You know, I love all this stuff when you start talking about it.
That's what I was looking forward to. So let's get into some right graphic detail. ironically as well, I don't know if I'm anymore, but I was a very, very squeamish person. So the whole hospital thing for me, that just freaked me out. Don't like hospitals, don't like needles, doctors, all that stuff. But in here, Myers, for between 4 and 6 weeks, things went from bad to worse. And it was at that point that there was a decision made to transfer me to the Glasgow Royal.
Yeah, it was I can remember just every day the update was getting a little bit more and more ominous. I mean, then at one point, I'm no longer getting updates from you, I'm getting updates from your wife.
Yeah.
And that's when you start to think, oh, shit, something's not right here.
Yeah. No, and I think, as I say, I spent some time in high dependency in Hare Myers as well. It's all a bit, some of it's a bit hazy for me. And I talked to Christine about it. Christine kind of fills in loads of blanks, clothes, a load of stuff that I've probably just purposely blanked out of my memory deliberately.
Really, so move to the Royal. Yeah. I guess luckily there's a consultant at the Royal who kind of specialises in what you have, isn't it?
Yeah. So that was the whole reason for getting moved to Royal, because a consultant there who's been looking after me, who is one of the specialists in this field and one of the top people in the UK, if not in the world. So I've been very, very fortunate that his care. I don't think if it wasn't for it being him. And we'll probably come on to speak a bit more about that. Yeah. But I'm quite adamant, and Christine said this as well, if it hadn't been him that night operating on me, I probably wouldn't be here today, given the way things transpired.
Yeah.
So it was interesting getting moved to Royal, because they blow light ambulance me.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
I didn't know that either.
And it was funny, because there was a guy driving, and there was a girl in the back of the ambulance kind of with me, and we're chatting away as you do, but the guy's driving was honestly unbelievable. He was absolutely flying. I didn't think it was a kind of blue light situation, but they blue lighted me.
I guess it's those wee things that might make the reality kind of hit home a wee bit. Now when you're thinking, hang on a minute, they're actually blue lighting me between hospitals.
Yeah, aye. Oh, that was definitely for me. I was like, hold on, I didn't think things were...
At this stage, were you still thinking, were you aware of the severity at that stage?
I don't think I was. I think
I'm not well, but
I realised it was different for just a normal, you know, I'm not feeling great, I need a quick, you know, but I didn't understand the magnitude of what it was. And I guess when I did go to the Royal, that was obviously my first interaction with that consultant. And he did explain things to me. He says things with pancreatitis can be very, very slow and you'll get bored and frustrated. He says, but that's a good thing. He says, if you're bored and frustrated, things aren't going badly. And with hindsight,
you should have been bored.
Well, what he was telling me, because sometimes, you know me quite well, so you know I get a bit antsy if I've not got something to do. I think in terms of, I was bored and starting to get frustrated, and he was very much, be careful what you wish for. And sure enough, you know, when things went wrong, they really went wrong.
So, to that point then, so I think I'd come in to see you a couple of days before, and then I text you, and we were in a text chat, and your last text message to me, because I remember looking at it for ages and weeks after this, was saying, I feel as best as I ever have. Feel really good and strong today. I feel like I'm on the turn. And that was the last text message I got from you for 6 months. So after you sent that text message, what did you do?
So in terms of what happened at that point, and again, it is something that's quite hazy, but I'll kind of try and remember as much as I can. So I was improving. So there was that improvement. They did a procedure on me to drain these collections that had happened. That went wrong, believe it or not. So that was an endoscope. So the camera down is endoscopically draining these collections, however they managed to do that. So I went through that procedure, and I remember waking up still on the table where they'd done the endoscope, and there was like kind of this, all I can describe it as brown toxic waste everywhere, all over me. And they'd kind of said when they did that endoscope, there was like way more fluid than they were expecting, and it went wrong, and when it came out, it ended up going everywhere. I went back, but when I went back to the ward that night after that procedure, I actually did feel, and that was probably when I texted you, I actually did feel well. I actually did feel, because I had been feeling pretty miserable at that point, and I think just obviously the release of that fluid out of my body. But then that was when things very, very quickly took a turn. That was when I started vomiting, and it was, and again, it was the only way I can describe it, is like vomiting toxic waste. It was horrendous. And I knew myself at that point. I thought, well, this can't be good. I don't know what's going on here. And that then, you know, that kind of progressed, and that kept going for a number of days. And obviously family coming to visit me and things like that, and I was just miserable. And then obviously I hadn't been eating or drinking or anything like that either. And I think it got to the point where I think Christine or somebody must have brought me an ice lolly to have. And I took some of the ice lolly, and it was great. It was just so refreshing to have a bit of an ice lolly. But then quite soon after that, I started vomiting, and it was blood that I was vomiting, which was pretty scary.
Can you remember all this?
I can remember this bit, and after this bit, this is when it starts to get hazy. So I started vomiting blood, and they kind of they sent me for a scan. I went for an RCT scan.
Did the nurse not come running in to help and slipped or something like that?
I think that's later on. But I think at that point, what happened is they sent me for another CT because they were worried about active bleeding, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think the CT didn't show any active bleed, so they were kind of a wee bit of a miss as to why I was vomiting blood at that point. But anyway, the consultant had been called, and he had come round, and he's like, "That's fine," and he was going home for the evening. And then obviously later that night, that was when it really took the turn for the worse, and I was literally, you know, I was just vomiting continuously, and it was just blood all the time. And at that point, you know, they invoked the, whatever it is, a major hemorrhage protocol, but there was people coming from all directions to see me, and I remember just being absolutely terrified. Because I thought, I'm dying here. This is not great. So the consultant got called back in. He was apparently going out for a meal with his wife, apparently, and he came back in. And by that point, there was people tending to me, and I get rushed down to the theatre. And I can remember in the theatre, I was literally begging them to put me to sleep because I was so distressed. And I remember saying to the nurse, just tell my family I love them. That was the last thing I kind of said to the nurse, and then I remember that they knocked me out. And after that, I don't really remember
At that point, you're thinking, I'm saying goodbye.
I didn't know if I was going to wake up again, to be honest with you. And so at that point, obviously they operated on me. And I remember, you know, the next thing I remember was being in the intensive care unit and waking up. And this is a bit where it starts to get hazy for me because I don't really remember an awful lot about it. But I remember waking up the intensive care unit, and you know, over the course of a few days to a week, I was actually making a bit of an improvement and starting to get better, to the point where the intensive care consultant came and spoke to me and said, "It looks like you're going to be good to get discharged downstream into a ward, into a regular ward." So that was great. I was feeling good and saying that was a, mentally that was a positive thing for me. I was really, you know, happy about that. But again, this is hazy, but whatever happened at that point, I took, you know, I kind of fell off a cliff at that point, because that was, I always remember going back and seeing that ITU consultant going, I was ready to discharge you that day to a ward. And So again, I had another hemorrhage, major bleed situation, but it was a lot worse than the first one. And again, I was rushed to theatre, and I think during that whole process, this is about this very hazy, but over a period of 5 days or 6 days, I think I had six or seven emergency operations. And at one point, I lost 95 units of blood, which is 15 times the volume of the blood in your body.
Which means, how much blood do you have? Is it like 9 liters or something?
So the consultant told me it was 15 times the volume.
Wow.
They ran out of blood for my blood group type in Scotland that night. They actually got blood flown up from Manchester for me. And he did say to me, if somebody had come into A&E that night needing blood of that blood group, they had a decision to make, were they giving it to me or giving it to them? Mm-hmm. So absolutely, you know, horrendous, petrifying.
But it's amazing to think of all the elements that are fighting for you to keep you alive in terms of, so blood getting rushed up from Manchester, all these consultants, everything going away, just doing their damnedest to try and keep you.
Yeah,
keep you going.
100%. And as I kind of alluded to earlier on, the consultant that was there that night, they couldn't find the bleed. They actually couldn't find it. He said literally when they didn't have a clamp on, whatever it was, the blood was actually spraying out onto his face. And he joked to me, and it was really funny. It was funny looking back on it. He was going out for his dinner with his wife that night. He didn't even have time to change. And apparently his shoes get wrecked.
So you owe him a pair of shoes?
I owe him a pair of shoes. But apparently, you know, during that, he'd worked in gunshot victims in Africa and lots of stuff. So he'd lots of kind of real emergency trauma experience. And apparently he got some radiologist to they put some kind of balloon up one of my main arteries and inflated it above my heart to allow them to control the bleeding. So by doing that, it stopped the blood flow enough for them to see where it was coming from. And then they actually managed to clamp that off or do whatever it was they did and fix that and then do it. So, and I think a lot of the stuff they did that night, some of it's made into medical journals and case studies, apparently. I think there's been quite a lot of case studies on what they actually did.
So I think the consultant deserves a name check. Who's the...
So his name's Ewan Dixon. Mm-hmm. The guy's an absolute genius, to be honest. Yeah. He didn't save my life. So
I think one of the things that came across, you're an analytical person and you like to understand things, sometimes to a fault, right?
I'll accept that.
I can remember with all the other doctors, you were getting massively, massively frustrated. But with your consultant, I think in terms of how brutally honest he was, with the facts, in terms of let's not try and make assumptions, it kind of resonated with your kind of more analytical side. And you did get a wee bit of peace from that in terms of saying, well, I trust him.
Yeah, definitely. And his whole approach was tackle one problem at a time and tackle it as it comes along, which did definitely help. And he did keep me in my box in terms of, because I was always trying to
give him ideas.
What's the next step? What's the next step?
What's
the next step?
Me?
He was good at that. And you know, I've got a lot of respect for that man, for what he did for me, obviously, clearly. It's just thinking back on it now, it's quite unbelievable to think. You know, some of the story that I didn't tell there was the whole thing around what happened after that bleeding, after those operations, stuff like that. So I was actually in intensive care, ventilated for 4 weeks.
Was it as long as 4 weeks?
It was four
Bloody
weeks.
Hell.
And during that time...
Are you completely out when you're ventilated, or you're
sedated, and they control the levels of sedation. So for a lot of that, I was completely out. Uh-huh. Obviously, they need to start reducing the sedation, easy for me to say, sedation to actually bring you back round and make sure you're coping and able to manage on your own. During that 4 week spell, I think it was multi organ failure. My kidneys were failing. I was on dialysis. I think at one point as well, my liver was failing, and they actually told Christine that if my liver didn't respond to treatment, there wasn't really anything else they could do for me.
I can always remember getting a call from Christine. We were going to a all hands event when we get all the staff together. We were just about to walk into the place, and I don't know if it's a nurse in her, but she's got a very deadpan way of delivering brutal news.
Probably a lot of experience in that.
Yeah, going, hi, how you doing? just to let you know that we've been told that Brian's in a critical way. And at one point she was saying it was from minute to minute. They were told, they've told us not to look over minute to minute. Then the next update was okay, it's now hour to hour. Yeah. Then eventually we got to day to day. But I don't think you were expected to survive at that point, were you?
No. Christine was called in basically, and, mm-hmm. and her and my mum actually stayed in the relatives room overnight that night. And she said that every now and then she could hear footsteps in the corridor, and she was terrified it was somebody that was going to come in to tell her I hadn't mm-hmm. made it.
Yeah.
She was getting, you know, previous to that she was getting phone calls for the consultant, and the consultant was saying to her, he's still alive. Mm-hmm. That was the update.
Uh-huh.
So that was how dire the situation was.
And it's clearly it's horrific for you, but it's also the wider family, isn't it?
100%. Yeah. Aye. I mean, in some ways obviously I've been through both the physical and mental trauma, but in some ways I think mm-hmm. Christine and the kids have suffered more mental trauma than I have, because
for a lot of the
worst times mm-hmm. I was, you know, unconscious basically.
From Christine, I've never met someone who acts like a guardian angel so much in my life.
I know.
And that woman had your back at every stage. Yeah. I can remember when I was in visiting in intensive care, there was consultants running away from her. No, I mean, she was formidable, but all she was doing was making sure somebody was fighting your corner. Yeah. I think it's because she works in the NHS as well. She knows that, you know, you need to push certain buttons and you need to do stuff. But I've never seen someone protect a loved one so much.
Yeah, I think in terms of, you know, interesting, her and the consultant that I was talking about, I don't think they saw eye to eye half a lot. I think it was mm-hmm. a lot of kind of run-ins.
Yeah.
But as you say, it was Christine was just looking at it from a best
every time.
And she still does, uh-huh. you know, even now. And I think she's got a bit of PTSD, even things like me going out and going mm-hmm. to places now. She's like,
Jordan,
where are you going? What are you doing? When you'll be back? Uh-huh. You know, she's very protective that way now as well. Yeah. But you know, I wouldn't get through this without Christine, if I'm being absolutely honest with you.
No.
She's been there for me. She's dragged me along. You know, some really, really dark times in intensive care, as you know, because mm-hmm. you saw me as well. But I think, you know, when I woke up for that, being ventilated, I literally could only move my fingers. Mm-hmm. I had to learn to walk again. I had to learn to do lots of stuff mm-hmm. again. And it was terrifying. And there was times in there where I was lying in that bed. And you remember that wee box room I was in, yeah. with no external windows mm-hmm. or anything. You know, there was times in there where, you know, I never ever gave up. I wouldn't say I gave up, but mm-hmm. there was times where I was in a really dark place.
Yeah.
And Christine would come in. And, you know, if it wasn't for Christine, sometimes it was tough love for Christine as well.
Oh, saying, absolutely.
But if I didn't have that, I don't mm-hmm. think I would have made it through the way I did. And there was, you know, there was other staff and people as well that were really key. The whole learning to walk again and stuff like that. There was a physio who, you know, I'm still in contact with now, and you know, quite friendly with, mm-hmm. That she actually was instrumental in getting me back on my feet and getting me to the point where even Christine was coming in some days and saying, geez, oh, is he actually using like kind of something called a standard? Uh-huh. Is he using that already and weight bearing himself? And she mm-hmm. says it was remarkable how quickly I got from nobody mm-hmm. even moved to that.
Because I don't think people realise what intensive care is until they actually have to either be in it or visit someone in it. Yep. So Christine, again, looking after you in terms of the mental side and all the rest of it, she was determined to get us all in. You probably didn't want us there in terms of what we're doing, but she was adamant, nope, you're coming in, come and see him. And of course, looking forward to seeing you, but as soon as you walk into that intensive care, and it shouldn't be a surprise, but no, it's all full of very sick people. No one was laughing or cheering or anything like that. So that took me away in terms of what that, then they took them into the room. The level of care was phenomenal. All these nurses coming in, they genuinely cared about you. You could see that. But I think for you sitting here now compared to, because you were sitting in a chair almost identical to that.
Yeah.
When I first came in, you couldn't lift your head.
No.
You actually couldn't lift your head. And I'm sitting there rabbiting shit, trying to fill the silence and stop myself from spewing because of all
the cables
and bleeps and liquids flying about. I'm looking at the ceiling and I asked something, what have you been doing today? Now, one of these idiotic things that you're like, well, actually what I've been doing today, and your answer will stay with me forever. You said, this week I've heard three people die. And I was like, oh, okay.
Not expecting that answer.
No, I wasn't expecting that answer because it was a room next to you.
It was, and I always remember it would, the room I was in, it had a special glass where they could flick the button and it made it opaque.
Yeah.
And I always remembered what they would do. So the glass would be, it would be clear in normal times.
Yeah.
And I'd be able to look out onto the ward. And then a nurse would come in and say, Brian, we just need to change the windows for a minute. Change the windows, and then you would see the shadow of a trolley getting wheeled past. And it was always the person that had been in the room.
Who didn't make it.
To the right, that didn't make it. Which was really, that was when you actually realise how dire a situation you're in, when people are literally dying and getting wheeled out of the place.
I think you're my next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was in, you know, intensive care for 84 days. Which is...
And that... Obviously, they don't put intensive care together to be aesthetically pleasing. It's a functional room.
Yeah.
In terms, but I think from the mental fortitude that you showed to be in that, because it basically was a glass windows box with machines.
Yeah.
No, for 84 days, for over 2 months.
And I would say now, mental strength-wise, my mental strength is probably through the roof of where it was previously now, just through the circumstance and to deal with that and be there and do it. And, you know, it was some long old days in there.
One of the things that you said to me in passing one time, and again, it's these wee throwaway things that resonate with you forever. When you're trying to give you a pep talk or trying to do something in terms of the thing you said, there's worse things than living.
Yeah.
There's worse things than dying, sorry.
Yeah.
There's worse things than dying, you think?
Yeah, and I think there was at certain points that, you know, that genuinely was how I felt.
Yeah.
Because you just thought, I think even at certain points you thought, how can I come back for this? Because obviously you go for flying along quite nicely, your life, you know, everything's going well, family's going well, job's going well, everything went to bang. You're in that glass box. You've got no real view. You know how I like a timeline for things?
Yeah.
You've got no real view on how long something's going to take. I think one of the biggest frustrations for me was, and that was where that consultant was great as well, he never ever gave you a timeline. He says it'll be where it'll be. When you're fit and well enough, that's when it'll be. And that was probably good for me to hear, because I was constantly going, when you know,
I want a date.
What's going to happen? He's like, I can't tell you. We don't have one. It'll depend how you react to certain things.
So after your 84 days, and I think in terms of what you were saying about mental fortitude, you know, I don't like to give you too many compliments, but in terms of bravery and sheer stubbornness, I think you win an award for that.
Yeah.
Because even in those darkest days, you were always moving forward. You're always moving forward to the point of, if they were asking you to do something, now Christine would maybe have to give you a ride for you to do it properly.
I think that, I think certain days that was definitely the case.
But you did it, and you carried on doing it, and I think the speed of your recovery to that is all down to your mental fortitude.
Yeah, I think one of the things I would say, and you know, what I'd say to him is, just never give up. You need to just keep going. And I've obviously watched your podcast a lot, and the stuff that you're doing around, you know, with Jesse and your training program, and you know, it's all about that. You know, it's not enjoyable, but you know you need to go up and do it and keep going. That is true, and it's amazing. So one of the things for me is, A, it's amazing what you can get used to, and B, it's amazing what you can accomplish.
That first thing you said there is amazing what you can get used to is beautiful and terrifying in the same right, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, because some of the things, even now, you know, because obviously I'm waiting to get the Humpty Dumpty operation for me to put me back together again. But even now, some of the things that I'm doing on a daily basis and what I'm used to now, if you'd told me that before all this happened, I would have told you you were crazy.
Yeah.
I would not have believed
and
that.
And I think you underestimate the kind of impact that your things had on other people's life. You couldn't watch what you've been doing from not being inspired, but also not take realisation. So within the date of your family, you were by far the fittest and healthiest person out the lot of us, by far. No, I mean, you led a very balanced lifestyle, with the rest of us, maybe not so much.
That's a sorry state of affairs.
No, you were a fit individual. You didn't overindulge in anything. You were quite a balanced, quite a balanced guy. That way, so it almost seems unfair that it happened to you rather than it happened to anyone else. But after that, that acted as a bit of a wake-up call for me as well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the things that I'm doing now and the changes I've made to a lifestyle probably are directly impacted by the realisation what I have, what your health means to you.
And that you're not invincible.
Aye, uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, definitely. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the things that is important to look after mm-hmm. yourself first and foremost with everything.
Mm-hmm. And if you weren't as fit as you were, you wouldn't be here either.
The doctors did say that to me. They did say part of the reason I made it was because I had a good degree of fitness. Mm-hmm.
So if there's someone, if there's someone sitting in hospital right now listening to this in a bad way, with all the mental anguish, if you were sitting next to them, what would you say?
So I would say to them, I completely understand that you're feeling down and things are really, really dark. You just need to keep going and you need to power through it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the only advice
I can give. It's perseverance, isn't it?
You've got to just keep going. That is it. When I was in hospital in some of the darker times, you know, there was obviously the hospital psychologists and stuff, where the doctors were really keen for me to speak to them. You know what I'm like. Yeah. I'm not a big believer in that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I really aren't. But, you know, it was desperation stages. I thought, well, there's no harm, give it a try. So the psychologist came along, spoke to me. And every single time they spoke to me, we got back to the same place. The only thing that was going to make me feel better was getting out of there.
Aye.
And that was what I said to her. I said, look, we can do whatever you want. You can tell me, you can say this, you can say that, all these techniques. The only thing that's going to make me feel better is getting out here mm-hmm. and getting better. And so, that was kind of where I got to. And she did, funny story, she did some mindfulness stuff for me, which was very nice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, it was great.
Passed an hour.
Yeah. I did a bit of literally passed an hour, but I've got quite a good story that recently. When, I don't know why, but I thought, I'm going to look at this mindfulness again.
Mm-hmm.
So I put on YouTube or one of these things. And so the thing comes out and says, like, clear your mind and, you know, close your eyes and imagine being somewhere. And unbeknown to Christine, I was doing this up the stairs and Christine started hoovering just as it says, clear your mind, what can you hear? So all I can hear now, whenever I think of mindfulness, I just think of Christine doing the hoovering.
The hoovering. Yeah, so, and that was you, done with mindfulness.
That was me done with it. So.
Uh-huh. I saw a funny thing on TikTok or YouTube, and it was a comedian talking about mindfulness, and he was saying that before iPhones, we all used to practice mindfulness, like sitting in the bus, watching the water drip down the window. He said that's now classified as mindfulness, and you would pay somebody to go and do that. So after your 84 days in hospital, you're by no means out of the woods there. So after that 84 days, how long were you back in the ward for? It was a good strange thing.
It's a good 2 or 3 months.
Uh-huh.
I get out just about the end of November, I think,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That year. But even when I get out, so obviously when they told me I was getting close to getting home and getting out, I thought, fantastic, that's great, going mm-hmm. home. I think I'll be home in time for Christmas. I'll be really good. What I didn't realise is how dependent you are on people in the hospital when you're there and how much you're getting done for you.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home at first, I could barely get up the stairs when I got home at first.
That was the test, wasn't it? Yeah. If you could...
Yeah, and that week, actually, and talking about, you know, just sheer will to get out of there. At the start of that week, the physio that I was telling you about, she came to see me and says, right, we need to get you doing stair practice, we need you doing this and that. And for some reason, I was in a load of pain in my abdomen. I had a lot of pain in my abdomen. I got all these drains and different things sticking in and out of me. And even just moving, it was really uncomfortable. And it got to the point where I was actually scared to get up out of the bed because it was so sore. And at the start of that week, you know, I tried to do a stair practice and that, how painful it was. And even the physio said to me, says, Brian, I don't think you're going to be ready to get out this week.
Oh, I stuffed this.
But that was a catalyst for me. So what we ended up managing to do, and again, the physio was instrumental in that, we worked out that, it doesn't take a genius to work this out, but we put a really compression bandage around my midriff,
uh-huh.
and that kept everything, and it really dealt with the pain,
mm-hmm.
and that went me, and then it was just sheer determination to get up and down those stairs enough for them to say, right, okay, you've done enough to get out, mm-hmm. and it really was, because when I got home, you're going up and down the stairs at home, I think I did 13 stairs in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and that was how many we had in the house, so deliberately, right, I can do 13, when I get home, try to do the stairs at home.
So how long was that you were in hospital for from start I was going to say you finished until your first time out.
It's a seven month stay.
Yeah. So when you leave the hospital, it must almost feel like you're in a film or something like that, or reality passes you by, or
feels kind of surreal because that whole 7 months has went by, and
but the world's just the same. It's just
It's just back to the way it was previously, almost. Clearly not, but it was a really odd feeling. Mm-hmm. It really was strange. It was such a relief as well to actually be getting out. But again, that was just the start of the next stage of recovery, and just managing at home, and you know, all this regime for keep myself. Obviously, still can't eat or drink or do anything like that. So need to feed myself through tubes and do bits and pieces in that way.
But in terms of your typical spirit, and this is going to make me sound like a draconian employer here, but you got out after being 7 months in hospital, and you were working again within something like 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think I was back working again very early in December.
Very early in December. Now, I would just like to say for all the lawyers listening that had absolutely nothing to do with me.
That was my own decision, clearly. Uh-huh. And you clearly were very, very concerned. For, I always kid John that you after Christine, you're the next person that sent me. Are you sure you're all right?
Coming for me, that's the only reason, Brian.
But you were obviously very, very cautious and very, very careful what you're doing, you know, don't be. But as I said to you back then, and I'm adamant to this day, psychologically, that was and is still brilliant for me, because when I got to that December date and started doing work again, and don't get me wrong, it probably took me a number of weeks to get up to any kind of sense of speed and being back to being able to cope with the rigors of what I needed to do. Uh-huh. Psychologically, it was great for me because it was normal. Uh-huh. And that was the biggest thing. And even till today, you know, my life's still nowhere near what it was before because I'm still restricted in what I can do and blah, blah, blah. But I think work has been a constant for me and it just feels like it's the way it's always been.
Yeah. No, as in, it's, again, it's remarkable to yourself how quickly you, because I genuinely thought you'd be doing the equivalent of colouring in for a while. I mean, I didn't expect you, but no, you were right in amongst the weeds again. And I can remember several times saying, stop, don't get involved in this. But you threw yourself right back into it. I don't know if that was a control thing as well, about I can control this, I can influence it, I can...
Well, absolutely. And I think there is an element of that. And you know, I do like a wee bit of control. But I think when you're in that hospital situation, everything's taken out of your hands. You're in control of nothing. So there probably was a big element of that.
Big element of control. So, but it's not all been plain sailing when you've been out either, has it?
No, unfortunately not. There's been a few wee speed bumps along the way.
So you've ended up back in hospital two or three times?
Yeah, I think three times. I think it's every time I tell you how well I'm doing, it seems to be the next 10 months. So you probably find after this, you'll get a phone call for Christine tomorrow.
Yeah, every time I get a text, I'm feeling good. I'm like, oh, shit. Can't bounce. So what's the next stages? Clearly, you've said you're still in the recovery phase. So what's next for you?
So I'm waiting on them doing the recovery operation for me. So they're planning to put everything back together the best they can. They've been waiting on me getting, obviously, fitter and stronger and able to do that. Just very recently, they've said to me they think I'm now at that level where I'm ready and they would be willing to operate on me again. So there's two consultants involved now. There's the original consultant I spoke about, and there's a new consultant who's to do with the nutritional team, because obviously all my stomach and my bowel and all these things will need to be all put back together in a manner. So they're planning on doing that operation at some point in the next few months, hopefully.
To ask a stupid question, that must be terrifying, thinking about that, because as you're sitting here just now, you're on an upward curve. You're getting more and more freedom from Christine in terms of she's letting you go further afield.
She's letting me come and speak to you.
Yeah, I know. Thank you, Christine. But I take it that's a big op.
It's a major operation. So there's 50% of me excited because I know I need to get it done, and it'll be great to actually be on I've been on a recovery for the last 2 years to get to a point to get operated on again, basically. Whereas after this one, hopefully that is then me on the road to recovery, to getting back to normal life. So 50% excited about that. But as I've told you, the consultant actually took me through and drew me a diagram of all the stuff they're going to do. And that was pretty scary. It's frightening. So, you know, and saying things like we need to clear the theatre list for the whole day for you and things like that just make you realise this isn't just going in and, you know, getting a very wee simple operation done.
The diagram was like a cabling diagram that we would put together on the data centre. Honestly, it was like, we'll take this and test and we'll hook up to here, we'll take this from here.
So it's got a lot of detail in it, and it is scary when you look at that. But I
guess you just see it as a necessary step, because you want to get back to as close to 100% as you can.
I'll never get to 100%, but I'm pretty confident I can get to 95. And if I can get to 95, and if you'd told me that at the start of all this, I'd bite your hand off, basically, where I'm at.
Because you've not eaten or drunk anything in, what, 2 years almost?
No, not properly in 2 years.
No. What would be your first meal?
Oh, that's a tough one. I do like a steak.
A steak?
That's it. But bizarrely, I've got a strange craving for Chinese food.
I get that. That's strange.
So I think David McKenna keeps promising me he's going to take me to the Ho Wong when I'm better. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, no, we go around and do the Ho Wong so much. But I take it after the operation, it wouldn't be day one Ho Wong.
No. I don't think so. I think it'll be baby food probably on day one. So obviously I'll need to build back up to, I imagine it'll be soups and yogurts and soft food building up to something. But I will still need to take things like tablets and stuff before it,
because the pancreas is gone, isn't it?
It's not gone but it's so badly damaged it's not doing anything, not really doing anything. So the pancreas has two main functions. It helps break down your food and stuff like that, and it controls the levels of insulin in your body. So I'm diabetic now as well through all this,
Which has been a struggle for you as well, isn't it?
It's been a struggle. That's been part of the struggles, is actually getting that under control. And ironically, because of the way I need to get fed and stuff like that, it actually makes it more difficult. So if my blood sugar goes low, because I don't really absorb anything, it's very, very difficult to bring it up. So they've always kind of said, keep your blood sugar on the higher side, because it's a lot easier to
fix that.
To fix that than it is anything else.
Because you can't eat a Mars bar or...
I can't just take a can of cola or whatever. Well, I could, but it wouldn't have any... I couldn't take the Mars bar. I could drink a can of cola, but it would just come straight back out and it wouldn't have any impact on me, really.
So the NHS, clearly, the NHS gets a lot of pelters as well. So there's a lot of good and there's a lot of bad. But I guess from your perspective, from what you've seen, it's mainly the people, isn't it, that keep that going?
My experience has been unbelievable. You know, I get kind of annoyed and frustrated when I hear people bad-mouthing it. They've been there for me every step of the way. The people, you know, you mentioned it yourself, the people in even, you know, every ward, not just intensive care, but they really did care, and they were actually rooting for you to get better, and they really had my back in terms of helping me get
and some of them pop in and see you, don't they, when they're...
It's amazing. Christine says I'm a celebrity in that hospital now, because every time I get in, there's loads of people know me, and they're like, oh, look at you, look how well you're doing. And as it's not the kind of place you want to be a celebrity, I don't imagine, but...
And they're all there still today, doing it for someone else.
Yep, absolutely.
And
the hours that they work, and, you know, there's people there that look after me, and it was like, you know, they were there constantly, absolutely constantly.
Right.
You know, there was one example, when I was really, really ill, and I was going through all those operations and stuff like that, the intensive care consultant was with me for 48 hours straight, Christine told me. She did not go home. She stayed for 48 hours.
That's incredible.
And stayed to make sure that everything that was getting needed to get done got done, and she was making sure it was all getting controlled. And so, I mean, that is, you'll talk about above and beyond.
And that's one patient?
One patient. And the place is, it's so busy. It's beyond belief.
And they're underfunded, they're understaffed, they're fighting a losing battle.
Yeah. As an organisation, they're on their knees as an organisation, but the people are still, you know, long, hard shifts looking after, caring for people, unbelievable.
And if you lived in America or something like that, you'd be bankrupt.
They would just have been turning the machines off, I think, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think they would be, I don't know, I don't know how accurate this is, but the consultant did say at one point you were into £5 million.
Well worth it. Well worth it, Brian.
Cheap at half the price.
I think so. Moving on slightly in terms of away from the bionic man that sits in front of me. So in your role as Chief Technology Officer, Data Beater, you've had one of the worst jobs probably over the last 3 months, which is not even that, probably 2 months, which is trying to sort out the commercial shit show, which is Broadcom buying VMware.
Yep.
So anyone who's not a techie now, you can just stop watching. Thanks for watching and goodbye.
Move on to the second segment.
But Broadcom, who are a big nasty American organisation, who have a history of taking really good tech companies and basically asset stripping them, I guess, to a point. And really underinvesting in them, taking out all the profit and screwing the customer base is a kind of MO. And we've seen that again, that behaviour with VMware. Now, I think VMware's impacted more because it's at the foundation of almost every bit of enterprise IT and every service provider data centre.
Yeah, it's so integral to what a lot of organisations are doing.
And that's why they bought it.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, in fairness, it is the best hypervisor available.
Yeah.
And it's not just the hypervisor element, as we well know, it's the whole ecosystem round about it. Mm-hmm. That's where the problem comes. The way they've done it, you know, the very, very little notice, the level of information, cancelling the partner programs for all partners, and then starting from scratch and basically ripping up how it worked before and completely changing that on such a short time scale and such an integral. I can't understand how they're allowed to do it in the manner they've done it, to be honest.
It's called greed and profit.
Well, yeah, I guess that is, but I get your, even just for the, your competition law perspective and stuff like that, because that is playing into, you know, the hands of public cloud and you know, these kind of providers as well, where that often, you know, becomes a lot more attractive potentially.
It's funny how VMware was always seen as the last bastion for the private ecosystem.
Yep.
And it's actually VMware who's tried to put the last nail in the coffin for that. And the guys at AWS and Microsoft, they must be absolutely rubbing their hands.
They will be. Mm-hmm. They will be, because, you know, we've done a lot of work looking at alternates. And there are, you know, it's not to say, I'm not saying for a minute there aren't any alternates out there, but you're not going to move from VMware to an alternate in a matter of a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes planning, it takes thought, it takes a whole migration process. It's the ecosystem, it's the biggest problem, is finding the tool sets that work with them. If I was a backup vendor or a DR tool vendor, I would definitely be all over looking at alternate hypervisors and try to make my products work with them, because that would open up a whole world of opportunity.
And that's where we got to. It was almost like a Rubik's Cube that was fighting us back, wasn't it? We'd think we'd get one solution, then you're, there's a white bit on the wrong side. So we spoke to everyone from Proxmox to KVM to Nutanix to Citrix. And we looked at everything in some few and weird wonderfuls in between. But if we look at a couple of different scenarios, within our data center, we have got a massive investment in the ecosystem. So VMware sits at the center of it.
Yep.
Then we've got a massive investment in storage and networking and backup and all these other systems monitoring that dwarf the size investment time, and they actually dwarf the actual VMware element. There's millions and millions of pounds of stuff, that's my wallet, that rely on VMware. So whatever way we moved, if we went to another hypervisor, one would say, okay, it works perfectly, but see that multi-million pound investment in your backup technology?
Yeah, you're throwing it out.
That throws it out, and all of the legacy data that's on that, you're going to have to migrate, and migrating backups is an absolute disaster.
Yeah,
then we said, okay, well, let's do this other one, because the backup vendor supports this. So let's look at this one. But then you'll need to put all your storage in the bin. So all those petabytes of storage that you have,
You're replacing it.
You're replacing it. So we've actually been kind of painted into a corner where the only solution is to try and re-architect our systems to work with it. So annoyingly, VMware... What was the drop-dead date for the termination of our contract? Was it the 31st of March?
31st of March, yep.
And we got our final pricing when? 2 weeks ago?
Yep.
2 weeks ago.
It wasn't even 2 weeks. About a week and a half ago.
About a week and a half ago. So we've been told since Christmas that our partner agreement's getting terminated at the end of March.
Yep.
And we'll need to buy via the new model, which...
with very little notice.
We found out. And it's not only that, there's new support, kind of interoperability now, or how it's put together. So that's left us in a situation.
And they want you to do a 3-year commitment.
Uh-huh.
So it's not just a on demand anymore. There is an on demand option, but you know, the on demand pricing is very, very
I think for one of our customers who we have an on demand model with, it was almost doubling the price. If we just passed that on to that customer, it would have been your cloud prices is now doubled. So I guess what have we done to mitigate that? Because I think there's a lot of valuable lessons. We've not been able to mitigate 100%.
No.
We are going to have to spend, we are spending hundreds of thousands of pounds, in, if not millions, on new compute, because our current CPU ratios, stuff we never had to worry about, we now need to worry about. So we're having to spend millions of pounds on compute to get to a model that works with VMware, because we're basically going for more powerful, higher consolidated core counts to go from that. So what advice can we give someone who's sitting there with an old VMware cluster who's received their renewal bill and it's double the price? What's from a techie, and don't, this isn't a data via sales thing, from a techie point of view, what can they do?
So I think first and foremost, you need to understand your workloads that you're running on that platform. You need to look at your architecture. You know, again, are you using physical segregation versus logical segregation, that kind of stuff? Is there consolidation that you can do in terms of that? What you really, the only way you can really get around it is understand your workload entirely. So whether that's, you know, making sure that your VMs that you've got aren't fat. So that, you know, you're running VMs with 4 CPUs when they could quite happily run with 1. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff to kind of slim down, trim down what you've got. Understand your CPU ratio as well too.
You know, so it's all about the CPU now?
It's all about the CPU.
And it used to be all about VRAM.
And it used to all about VRAM. Uh-huh. So it completely flips in his head. The whole thing around CPU ratio, you know, I know we often have conversations about CPU ratio. You know, make sure you understand that fully, and make sure you understand, you know, what good practices and stuff like that. You know, people, again, the whole reason virtualization was born was to get that ratio. And obviously, the higher the ratio you go, depending on your VM workloads, you do run a risk that you could potentially have some performance impact for certain workloads. But there is a sweet spot where you can actually get it right and probably save yourself a pile of money as well. So it's all about, you know, I like the sound of my own voice, but in one word, it's all about optimization, CPU optimization, really.
And I guess it's the poor buggers that either have very, very low core counts in terms, old CPUs basically.
Yeah.
Because there is it doesn't matter if you've got 7 cores, they're going to charge you for 16 regardless.
Yeah, it's a minimum 16 cores per CPU.
And we know of a lot of customers who have actually optimized their core count for Microsoft licensing purposes.
Yeah.
So they did the right thing and said, actually, we can reduce our licensing purposes by making sure that we've got a certain amount of sockets and a certain amount of cores. And with the new VMware model now, it absolutely decimates it. But I think the market will react to this as well. I think it's going to have to. I think you're right in terms of, I think the interoperability will improve with the likes of other vendors. It's going to have to.
I think for me personally, a plan B wouldn't be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because
if they do this, what's the next move?
Yeah, who knows going forward. And they do have history with, you know, Symantec and things like that, where they have done, and you say that, asset stripping, you know, what's to stop them in 3 years' time saying, right, let's do another, let's try and get, you know, get another chunk of cash out of this.
Well, what's next? A customer that uses Site Recovery Manager, they triple the price?
Yeah.
Quadruple it? Discount it?
But that also, if you think about it, that plays into what's to stop public cloud providers and these big, you know, mega organisations turning around and saying, you know what, we're going to rip up the rule book and completely change.
Yeah.
And what levers do you have at that point? Because obviously an organisation like that, they decide to do that, you know.
And that is a worry with public cloud, because there's a lot more in public cloud than
now
than there is sitting with VMware. So Well, thanks very much for coming on. Thank you. Always, enjoy the chat. Yeah, it's quite therapeutic in here, isn't
it? Yeah, it's really nice. Yeah.
You forget there's cameras sitting around with you. I think in terms of a Data Vita point of view, we'll probably do more of these kind of techie chats in terms of what you're doing. But I thought it was really important to get the story out of you. Because hopefully there's somebody sitting in the Royal just now who stumbles across the podcast, and it gives them a wee bit of hope. So,
well, if it gives it MD any kind of hope, then that would be, it's been well worth doing.
Excellent. So. Cheers, Brian.
Thank you. Cheers.